1. Sur de Bienville, with drainage ditches along each block to house the garrison that would control what ships entered the Mississippi. It didn't take long for residents to recognize the danger posed by the river. Within a year, flooding led Bienville to order the creation of the first artificial levees along the river, extra compacted dirt packed 3 feet high. Over the next 2 centuries, the levees proved insufficient as floods came through the city. More dirt was added, stronger materials were incorporated, and the levees grew higher. Settlements grew north along the river, and the levees grew with them. By the mid-19th century, more than 1,000 miles of levees had been constructed to contain it. Meanwhile, the field of engineering had begun to grow into a discipline, applying physical laws and calculations to the construction of our essential structures. Engineering as a concept has been part of human existence since the pyramids, but the more formal subfield began mostly as a military discipline. The first American engineers were with the Army Corps of Engineers, established in 1802, and given the charge of founding and operating the Military Academy at West Point. Civil engineering was later defined as those activities that were not military. Civil engineering schools contained within universities were established in the 19th century. These newly minted engineers came to the Mississippi River determined to take control. Floods are unique among hazards in that, in coping with them, we must balance the need for containment with our other essential uses for water. Flood water must be disposed of, but it must also be preserved for dry times, only more so in the arid West, while also retaining access to rivers for the transport of goods. No one needs to bottle up earthquakes or magma to sell next summer. In flooding, our most ubiquitous hazard, our need for protection can be at cross purposes with our other economic necessities. Since the mid-19th century, engineers on the Mississippi River argued over these objectives, trying to both protect the land from flooding and keep the river open for navigation. They fought over approaches and objectives in a dispute complicated by the rivalry between the established military engineers in the Army Corps of Engineers and the newly developing cadre of civil engineers. The historian John Barry, in his book Rising Tide, chronicles what became a very personal conflict between General Andrew Humphreys, a West Point engineer and eventual chief engineer of the Army, and James Buchanan Eads, a civil engineer whose entire professional life had been committed to the Mississippi, primarily to modifying it to better suit navigation. Humphreys seemed driven by vindictiveness and territorialism. In spite of his own report that made it seem impractical, he came down firmly on a levee-only approach, and he pulled the Army Corps with him. Their idea was that by keeping all the water within the river with high artificial levees, they could speed up the flow of water. The faster water would carry more sediment, and could scour out the sediment that had already been deposited, removing sandbars. The floods would be stopped by the levees, and shipping channels could stay open. James Buchanan Eads had an intimate knowledge of the Mississippi few could rival. To run a salvage operation, he had developed a diving bell and had literally walked the riverbed for years. He didn't believe that the levees would provide the scour needed to clear out the sediment that blocked navigation. He pointed out that they were built quite far back from the main part of the river and confined the water only when the river was in flood. He wanted to build jetties near the mouth of the Mississippi to focus the water flow on the area of recurring sandbars. He prevailed to a degree, but because of Humphreys' opposition, These jetties were built only when Eads promised to cover the cost if they failed. Both men opposed reservoirs and dams that could reduce the water flowing into the river during floods. By the late 19th century, Congress had tried to call an end to the fighting by establishing a Mississippi Commission that involved both military and civil engineers, and that was supposed to bring science to bear on the proceedings. But this political approach ended in a very political solution that turned out to be wrong in most particulars. It rejected reservoirs, which would have kept the water out of the river to begin with, and it rejected spillways and outflows, which would have allowed water to be diverted in the case of floods. It put all its eggs in a basket of levees. And for a while, it worked. In retrospect, all parties could have heeded Mark Twain's admonition when he said, "The Mississippi River will always have its own way. No engineering skill can persuade it to do otherwise." The principle that faster flow would scour sediment was based on a reasonable theoretical model. But the reality is that the Mississippi is a complicated system, and this reasoning fell apart in the details. First, because of the depth of the river, with much of its bed below sea level, the current wasn't uniform. The top of the water column was being pulled downhill by gravity, but the bottom wasn't. Friction between the water and the riverbed further distorted the currents. Second, the meanders in the river meant that the water moved faster on the outside of its curves than it did on the inside, leading to scouring on one side of the river and sediment deposit on the other. The excessive scour on some sides could actually start moving out the dirt on which the levees were built, undercutting them, and in the extreme, leading to their failure. Considering the amount of water that routinely came down the river, it's a marvel they held as long as they did. The rains began in August 1926. Heavy rainfall damaged the harvest across the upper Midwest, from Indiana to Kansas, Illinois, and Nebraska. Floods spread through towns, drowning people, breaking pipelines, flooding crops. The rains continued into October, usually a relatively dry time, and Illinois and Iowa recorded flood stages higher than ever seen before. Precipitation continued into the winter. The U.S. Weather Bureau reported that on the three great rivers of the Mississippi drainage, the Ohio, Missouri, and Mississippi, every river gauge they had was recording the highest levels they had ever seen. On Christmas Day, 1926, floods ran through Chattanooga and Nashville, two Tennessee cities on different rivers. The rains continued unabated. Five different storms, each bigger than any other storm of the previous decade, struck the area around the lower Mississippi. In January, Pittsburgh and Cincinnati flooded. In February, it was Arkansas's turn, as levees broke on the White and Little Red Rivers and flooded 5,000 people out of their homes. The storms in March spawned tornadoes that killed 45 people in Mississippi. Eventually, the man-made structures on which engineers for the last century had based all their defenses began to give way. Spring represents the most dangerous time for river flooding, when melting snow adds to the rain. In the spring of 1927, so much water came into the lower Mississippi, below the confluence with the Ohio and Missouri rivers, that the water itself began to act like a dam. The crests of floods moved more slowly, like cars compressed in a traffic jam. This only increased the pressure on levees. In the lower Mississippi area, this included not only the national mainline levees that had been constructed by the Army Corps of Engineers and were designed to control the Mississippi and its larger tributaries, but also the local and state levies covering smaller tributaries. All were overseen by levy boards. Created by local and state governments, these boards often held the power of taxation, and they were responsible for local maintenance. The 1879 Act that had created the Mississippi River Commission recognized the local boards and their role in keeping the system functioning. And so, as the Crests approached, the levee boards stood up for the fight. The mainline levees were massive structures, standing two or three stories high and constructed from compacted earth. They were set back from the main river channel by as much as half a mile or more. They were built at a 3-to-1 slope, which means that a levee that stood 30 feet high at its highest point would be buttressed on either side by a slope that spanned 90 feet in length, with a minimum of 8 feet of width at its highest point. They were so vast as to seem impregnable. But the risk the levees faced was twofold: the pressure of the river and the malevolence of the humans in their vicinity. The confined river put immense pressure on levees, and an at-risk town's best defense could be to sabotage the levee on the other side of the river. Once one side failed, the pressure on the other was eased. So, in a real-life prisoner's dilemma, a community that was threatened and had the means, the desperation, and the shamelessness could stay safe by putting its neighbors underwater. Thus, the first and foremost function of the levee board patrols was to find and stop any saboteurs who wanted to protect their community at the expense of others. Close to a dozen people up and down the river were shot and killed by guards. Some of them may have been inadvertent casualties, but several were found to have explosives on them. Of the levees that did fail, it was hard to tell after the flood had passed whether there had been a human hand in the damage. Sitting at the end of the Mississippi, where it meets the Gulf of Mexico, New Orleans had witnessed the failures that had taken place farther upstream, demonstrating to the city fathers the severity of the floods. In late April, the city's levees started to show signs of imminent failure. New Orleans had both the resources and the arrogance to, without stealth, dynamite the levee in St. Bernard Parish, a few miles to the east of the city. More than 10,000 residents were flooded out of their homes in St. Bernard and Plaquemine parishes. New Orleans later proposed a pool of $150,000 as a compensation fund for their subterfuge, less than $20 per victim. They eventually paid out several million, and even that they considered a good deal for keeping the water out of their city. In addition to guarding against saboteurs, the second function of the levee boards was to look for natural leaks and shore up weak spots. This meant backbreaking labor, shifting dirt at a time when there wasn't much mechanical equipment available to help. It is here, more than in the effects of the natural disaster itself, that the greatest atrocities of the flood of 1927 began to be exposed. The rich soil of the Mississippi floodplain had been the center of the Old South's cotton plantations, and by the 1920s, with the exception of the overseers, the labor force was still completely African American, working in conditions not much different from slavery. That winter, several farmers in Louisiana had kidnapped a family of African Americans at gunpoint and taken them to Mississippi, where they were sold for $20. The victims were forced to work without pay for weeks, watched by armed guards. The white farmers were eventually indicted, but their egregiousness is telling. When labor was needed to shore up the levees, plantation owners were asked to send their African American tenants to do the work. When that labor was insufficient, African American men were conscripted off the street, often at gunpoint, to fill out crews. As the Mississippi rose in the late winter, the levees were manned by white foremen with guns, looking for saboteurs, and making sure African American laborers stayed on the job. Publicly, the levee boards and the Army Corps of Engineers continued to insist that their structures were up to the task. But internal reports indicated that they knew otherwise. The Weather Bureau, the predecessor to the National Weather Service, said, "There was needed neither a prophetic vision nor a vivid imagination to picture a great flood in the lower Mississippi River the following spring." As winter turned into spring and the most dangerous times for flooding arrived, more and more men were conscripted to man the levees. By the middle of March, the Mississippi National Guard had been called out to defend them. Levees had broken on three main tributaries, the White, Red, and St. Francis Rivers. By early April, over 1 million acres of land was already underwater. The beginning of the end for the defenses of the lower Mississippi came with the rainstorm of Good Friday, April 15th. 15 inches of rain fell in New Orleans in just 18 hours, in a storm that extended over the whole lower Mississippi. Laborers were kept topping the levees, piling up sandbags to add to the height. On April 16th, at Dorena, Missouri, a 1,200-foot stretch of the mainline levee finally crumbled, and 175,000 acres were flooded. More levees failed in the next few days. The worst came at Mounds Landing near Greenville, Mississippi, on April 21st. The levee was trembling as the water started to percolate through it. African Americans working on the levee realized it was failing and tried to leave, but they were forced back at gunpoint. When the failure finally came, many of them were swept away to their deaths. Indifferent to African American fatalities, the Red Cross officially reported just 2 deaths at that break. In his book, Rising Tide, John Barry cited contemporary newspaper reports. Thousands of workers were frantically piling sandbags when the levee caved. It was impossible to recover the bodies swept onward by the current at an enormous rate of speed, wrote the Memphis Commercial Appeal. "Refugees coming into Jackson last night from Greenville declare there is not the slightest doubt in their minds that several hundred Negro plantation workers lost their lives in the great sweep of water which swept over the country," wrote the Jackson Clarion Ledger. The failure of the levee at Mounds Landing created a crevasse, the term for a break caused by erosion, that inundated the Mississippi Delta. The water poured through it at a rate twice that of the Niagara Falls. Within days, 1 million acres were submerged under 10 feet of water. Many people died immediately of drowning, but most escaped to high ground. In numerous cases, the highest ground was atop the levees themselves, those that hadn't failed. Thousands crowded onto the tops of these strips of land, each no more than 8 feet wide, surrounded by water, the Mississippi to the west and their flooded homes to the east. Flooded farms covered an area 50 miles wide and 100 miles long. More than 180,000 people lived in the region. Almost 70,000 ended up in refugee camps. The headline at the New Orleans Times-Picayune screamed, "For God's sake, send us boats." Boats came, and the ugliest parts of the community's soul were bared. The majority of the Mississippi Delta's residents were African American, living in conditions that hadn't much improved in the decades since abolition. After the Civil War and Reconstruction, the whites of the region had reasserted their authority through sharecropping and Jim Crow laws. Unable to vote or own land, African American tenant farmers occupied a tragic position, in debt to plantation owners, treated as less than fully human, but their underpaid labor so critical to a plantation's economic functioning that its owner did the utmost to ensure they couldn't leave. In Greenville, Mississippi, the city in the direct path of the Mounds Landing crevasse, the head of the local Red Cross, William Alexander Percy, was aware of the horrendous conditions on the levees. He begged for whatever boats could be mustered to evacuate blacks and whites alike. His father, Senator Leroy Percy, and other white leaders overruled him. When the boats at last arrived, only white families were allowed to board. The African Americans were left behind, without clean water, without food, without protection from the continuing rain. In Washington, President Calvin Coolidge had been doing his best to keep the federal government out of the local affairs of the flooded midsection of the country. He had for months ignored calls for help until the crisis at Mounds Landing threatened to overwhelm residents of the region, and he could ignore it no longer. Five of the affected governors had been calling for the Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, to be put in charge of a special federal rescue effort. On April 22nd, the day after the failure at Mounds Landing, Coolidge held a cabinet meeting and agreed to this request. A quasi-governmental commission was created, which included five cabinet members and the vice chairman of the American Red Cross. Hoover had come to public notice because of his humanitarian relief work in World War I. A geologist, trained in the first class to graduate from Stanford University, Hoover had made a fortune in mining, especially in Australia and China. He was living in London as a mining engineer and financier when the Great War began, and thousands of Americans were stranded in Europe with most of their travelers' checks and other financial assets unusable. In response, Hoover organized the American Committee, lending money and arranging for passage home. From there, he expanded his efforts, leading the Commission for Relief in Belgium, bringing food to the civilian population caught between the armies of the great powers. When America entered the war, President Wilson asked Hoover to lead the U.S. Food Administration, which managed to successfully maintain the nation's food supply throughout the conflict. Afterward, his organization helped feed millions across Europe. By the end of the war, he was being hailed as the great humanitarian. Hoover found that making money no longer interested him. He was making more money, he said, than probably was good for anybody. He was well known because of his war work and courted by both the Democrats and the Republicans. He chose to run for the Republican nomination for president in 1920, but his campaign fizzled. He had been so long outside the country that he didn't have a strong enough constituency to support his candidacy. He threw his support behind Warren Harding, who rewarded Hoover with a position as Secretary of Commerce. After Harding died, Hoover remained at Commerce under his successor, Calvin Coolidge. He stayed visible to the public through his media campaigns, but there was only so much interest he could generate in the subjects of regulating radio frequencies or conferences on street traffic. By early 1927, most articles considering possible presidential contenders for the 1928 election didn't even mention him, and those that did commented on how much the Republican establishment disliked him. Leading the flood relief efforts in the spring of 1927 allowed Hoover's strengths of management, engineering, and humanitarianism to shine. This was 50 years before the Federal Emergency Management Agency would be created, an organization devoted to, among other things, the distribution of funds. President Coolidge absolutely refused to consider federal funding of the effort. This was consistent with a long-held view in the United States that disaster relief ought to be a local, even a personal issue, and that it was inappropriate for the federal government to take money gathered from everyone and spend it on the needs of just a few. In 1886, President Grover Cleveland had vetoed a bill to help farmers in drought-stricken Texas, saying, "I can find no warrant for such an appropriation in the Constitution, and I do not believe that the power and duty of the general government ought to be extended to the relief of individual suffering, which is in no manner properly related to the public service or benefit. The lesson should be constantly enforced that though the people support the government should not support the people." The vehicle for disaster relief at the time was the American Red Cross. In recognition of its importance, it was ceremonially chaired by the President of the United States. In 1926, President Coolidge lauded the work of the Red Cross, saying its aid is given freely and in such a way that the benefactor does not feel himself an object of charity. He does not lose his self-respect. He further emphasized, "The normal state of the American people, the standard toward which all efforts are bent for attainment, usually with success, is that of a self-supporting, self-governing, independent people." The only appropriate source of relief funds, he suggested, was philanthropic donations. And so, the day after the Mounds Landing levee failure, President Coolidge called for donations to the Red Cross. $5 million was received in short order. The Flood Relief Committee that Hoover was asked to chair was to be quasi-governmental, with the Red Cross involved in its coordination. But over 26,000 square miles of land had been flooded, displacing more than 600,000 people and requiring a bigger relief effort than had ever before been seen in the United States. It was quickly clear that the scale of it could not be adequately addressed by normal donations. Still, the president persisted in his unwillingness to permit federal funding. He even refused to call a session of Congress to discuss it. So to raise money, Hoover turned to his skills with the media, developed while serving as Secretary of Commerce. He established campaigns to expose Southern suffering to residents in the North. It worked. Donations to the Red Cross increased to over $16 million. This had the added benefit for Hoover of putting him in the national spotlight, the hero of the flood relief effort. Back in Greenville, Mississippi, white families had been moved into the second stories of flooded businesses and hotels, while a colored camp was set up atop the levees, where African-American victims continued to reside. The camp was guarded by armed white National Guardsmen. The 13,000 occupants were required to wear large numbers on their clothing to make it easier to keep track of them. They had to work in order to earn their food, and numerous instances were reported of men being beaten for asking to rest. The supplies intended for all the 50,000 people affected in Washington County were shipped to Greenville and unloaded by black workers, but they were not the recipients. Separating the races meant that better provisions and medical care could be assigned to white refugees. One African American was shot for attempting to bring food into the camp. These abuses were horrific, but they were far from the worst or only problems for African American refugees in relocation camps. On May 8th, the Chicago Defender, the nation's largest newspaper for African American readers, published an exposé of the reality of the Greenville camp. It described refugees herded like cattle to stop escape from peonage. The Chicago Tribune picked up the story, pushing the Red Cross for comments. Prominent progressives, including Jane Addams, the suffragist, social worker, and Nobel Peace Prize recipient, called on Hoover to investigate and stop the mistreatment. The crisis threatened the media image that Hoover had been cultivating. Hoover responded by asking Robert Moton, the president of the historically black university, the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, to form a Red Cross colored advisory commission to learn whether African American victims of the flood had been abused in matter of treatment, living conditions, work details, and relief given. This committee brought to Hoover and the Red Cross their draft report on June 14, 1927, documenting cruelties in some of the camps, especially Greenville, where the refugees were forced to work in essential slavery, often beaten or raped by white guards. They confirmed that most of the donations of food never reached the colored camp. In submitting his report, Moton told Hoover to feel free to make any changes or additions that may seem desirable to you. The report that Hoover released downplayed any significant problems. It documented minor misdeeds, but otherwise praised the efforts of the American Red Cross to help the colored race. Privately, Hoover accompanied the report with promises of reform for the African American community should he be elected president the following year. He assured Moton unprecedented access to the White House and hinted that he would break up the plantations of bankrupted farmers, allowing African American farmers to own the land they vacated. Sensing an opportunity, Moton worked in 1928 to support Hoover's candidacy. Southern African Americans were unable to vote in general elections, but they had significant influence in the primaries, since comparatively very few Southerners belonged to the Republican Party. With the help of Moton and Tuskegee, the image of the great humanitarian swiftly addressing the greatest natural disaster in U.S. history swept Herbert Hoover first to the Republican nomination and then to a landslide in the general election. Like De Carvalho in Lisbon 170 years earlier, Herbert Hoover discovered the political rewards showered upon a politician who helmed an effective, or seemingly effective, emergency response. Also like De Carvalho, Hoover seized the opportunity to bring about long-term improvements, politically and structurally. The tension that arose from the unprecedented need of hundreds of thousands who had lost everything, the failure of government-run levees to stop the flooding, and the obvious inadequacies of private donations in relief efforts sparked vehement debate about the federal government's role in disaster management. Every Hearst newspaper carried an editorial demanding that Congress take action. When President Coolidge refused to do so, the New York Times, for its part, praised him for his restraint. Still, there was a strong push to provide help to the people who had lost so much. Congress moved to create a massive aid bill, one that President Coolidge vehemently opposed. In addition to thinking it outside the bounds of the federal government, He worried that much of the aid had become pork barrel politics, benefiting wealthy southern landowning interests and not the people truly in need. But caught up in the debate was the federal role in flood control more broadly. It was obvious that a very different, much more comprehensive approach was needed if the nation were to have any hope of preventing similar floods in the future. Hoover used his momentum to create one of the greatest civil engineering projects in history, the 1928 Flood Control Act. It provided congressmen a way of showing that they were acting while allowing the traditionalists to assert that they were not providing individual handouts. With it, the federal government committed to building a massive flood control system for the Mississippi River. It buried once and for all the Army Corps of Engineers' levee-only policy, building reservoirs to keep water out of the rivers and spillways to redirect it before it could break further levees. The money spent by the affected states in responding to the 1927 flood was counted as matching funds, so the federal government could supply the whole cost of the project without setting a precedent for always doing so in the future. The law also exempted the federal government from liability in the case of the system's future failures. Where the act failed, however, was in supporting individual victims. Two-thirds were African American, and their countless legitimate claims found no real purchase in Washington. The Flood Control Act has guided federal action and massive federal investments in the development of the Mississippi Valley and the direction of American society in the century since it was enacted. The lower Mississippi has never again suffered from riverine flooding as it did in 1927. Flooding in 2011 approached the size of 1927, but the effective use of spillways protected the levees. The act also set a precedent for federal dollars being spent on regional infrastructure for the greater good of society, an idea that would fully come into its own under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his New Deal acts, such as the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Works Progress Administration. Roosevelt, too, owes his election in part to the consequences of the Great Flood. The Colored Advisory Commission's report, as it was released in whitewashed form, may have kept the abuses of refugees from the larger white community, but the African American community was not so easily hoodwinked. Beginning with its coverage of the camps in the spring of 1927, the Chicago Defender continued to dig, keeping the issue in front of its readership. It published accounts from refugees throughout that summer, documenting conditions approaching a new slavery. At first, readers appealed to Secretary Hoover, assuming that his colored commission had simply missed these cruelties. As time went on, it became clear that he was deliberately avoiding them. In October 1927, the Defender published an open letter from the camps by a Mrs. Willis Jones, which resonated with readers. She wrote, "We didn't know the Red Cross was supposed to help us till by chance we saw a Chicago Defender. We were shocked to see that money and clothes were collected for our benefit while mothers and children lay on straw and naked floors. The most unkind words we received were when we asked for clothes and food from the Red Cross." Editorials were written decrying the Uncle Toms abasing themselves to the white leadership while their race was re-enslaved. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which took a less accommodating approach than Tuskegee, kept the issue alive. Still, Hoover won most of the African American vote in 1928. How could African Americans vote for anyone but the party of Lincoln? The divorce was beginning, though. Hoover had lost 15% of the African American vote in 1928, the first time the Republican nominee had received anything less than near total support. After the election, it became clear, as it too often does, that the promises that had been made were empty. Moton's calls were ignored, and no discussion of redistributing land in the Delta ever came about. So confident was Hoover that African Americans would never leave the Republican Party that he reneged on everything he had promised or implied. Hoover underestimated the outrage his betrayal would inspire. By 1932, many in the African American community had decided that Roosevelt's populist big government message was a better bet than the duplicity of his Republican rival. Roosevelt won only a third of the African American vote in 1932, but he won 70% in 1936. Since then, a Republican nominee has never again garnered more than 40% of the African American vote. Natural disasters are disruptions to human systems. Human systems function physically through sewers and power grids, roads and bridges, dams and levees, as well as socially, through families and friends, churches and synagogues, city councils and legislatures. All those systems have weaknesses, and an extreme natural event puts stress on them. Failures happen where the system is weakest. In Mississippi, we observed a gross failure of the levees, but perhaps more meaningfully, a failure of our society. The Mississippi floods exposed a fundamental weakness in the American social order, a tendency to minimize, dehumanize, and victimize those viewed as other, especially African Americans. The best investment in a resilient community is to identify such weaknesses and repair them before the event. Such an approach improves lives for everyone during disasters and in between them. The brutal, lopsided response to the Mississippi flood of 1927 was not uniquely American, as the Japanese attacks on Koreans in the wake of the Kanto earthquake well demonstrate. The evolution of human history might be seen as a gradual expansion of the concept of personhood, from identifying with one's own tribe, to the development of the concept of a nation, to an expanding acceptance of the larger world. You don't have to look far into these examples or into today's news to recognize that we still have a long way to go. Disasters can, at times, bring out the best in us. When the torrent from Mound's Landing first spread over Greenville and the Delta, people who hadn't been able to escape ahead of the waters were left stranded in trees and atop the ruins of houses. The first boats to come to their aid belonged to bootleggers. Although risking exposure themselves, many spent days hunting for and rescuing survivors. In the maelstrom created by a levee break in Arkansas, at the height of the crisis on April 20th, a steamboat crashed and capsized. An African American named Sam Tucker jumped alone into a rowboat and headed toward the break, where he was able to pull two men to safety. After the adrenaline of the disaster has passed and we face the dreariness of loss, despair lurks around the corner. Unable to attribute our misfortune to random chance, we wonder what we did wrong. Homes gone, dependent on the goodwill of strangers, fearing financial ruin, perhaps with loved ones killed, we look for someone to blame. We turn on the outsider. A disaster can alter the behavior of the individual, like one who is part of a mob, divorcing us from our moral compass. We must remember the most dangerous threat in a disaster is the threat to our humanity. Chapter 7, Celestial Disharmony. Tangshan, China, 1976. When the high and low are in disharmony, yin and yang become confused and bizarre occurrences are born. Dongzhengshu, circa 150 BC. My first view of Beijing came 1 week after my 24th birthday, in February 1979. I stepped off a plane to a colorless city. The only billboards bore aphorisms in Mao's calligraphy. Serve the people. Oppose revisionism. China was just recovering from the Cultural Revolution. Everyone wore blue or gray Mao suits. A woman with a colored scarf was the height of daring. When spring came, the trees brought green into the city's sky, but no grass grew on the ground. Citizens were required to pull it because it harbored insects. I arrived that winter day because I had been chosen to be part of the first academic exchange between America and China since the Chinese Revolution in 1949. I was a graduate student in seismology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, but also fluent in Chinese after a couple of years in Taipei, Taiwan. My research proposal was to study the 1975 Haicheng earthquake, a magnitude 7.3 event that the Chinese government claimed had been predicted, saving thousands of lives. I had a second, less official goal, which was to understand what had happened in the 1976 Tangshan earthquake, which had not been predicted and had destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives. What was the reality? Was earthquake prediction really possible? Seismology had come a long way since its beginnings in Japan. To be able to monitor compliance with the 1963 Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the United States had created the Worldwide Standardized Seismograph Network, WWSSN, a system of 120 seismic stations around the world. The goal was to be sure we could detect any underground nuclear explosion larger than the test ban limit of 150 kilotons, about the same energy as a magnitude 5.5 earthquake. But that also meant we now recorded every magnitude 5.5 or bigger earthquake around the world. And significantly, that data was not classified. Seismology departments could purchase microfilm sets of all of it. It changed the way we saw the world. We could now see that earthquakes happened in very narrow bands across the planet, and how those bands correlated with the bathymetry, the depth of water, and residual magnetism of the seafloor, data that had come from naval work in World War II. These were the linchpins of the plate tectonics revolution that upended the earth sciences in the 1960s. We learned that the top layer of the earth, called the lithosphere, was broken into big plates, about a dozen around the world. These plates move around at very slow speeds, no more than a few inches per year. Most of the world's earthquakes happened at the edges of the plates as they scraped past each other. Except in China. The only plate boundaries near China seemed to be to the east, in subduction zones off Japan, and to the south, where the Indian subcontinent moves north into Asia, pushing up the Himalayas. And yet, China is plagued with frequent earthquakes, many of which, because of China's population density, have been some of the deadliest in history. As the plate tectonics model came together, China was the one place that didn't seem to fit. Why did so much of China have earthquakes? Where were the plate boundaries? The first answer came in a seminal paper in 1975 by a young American seismologist, Peter Molnar, and a French geologist, Paul Tapenier. Peter was an assistant professor at MIT, and Paul had come to MIT to work with him as a postdoctoral researcher. In their paper, they showed that India's northward trek was not just pushing up the Himalayas, but also pushing China out of the way, squeezing it to the east. In the same way that picking up a heavy rock is harder work than picking up a light one, as mountains grow taller, it takes more and more energy to continue to push them upward. More rock has to be elevated against the force of gravity. At some point in the Earth's history, the Himalayas got so high that it took less energy to move the land that composes China to the east than to continue to push the Himalayas up. Long, fast faults formed that pushed the land of Tibet up and east and pushed China into the Sea of Japan. Most of the resulting earthquakes hit western China, in the highlands of Tibet, Xinjiang, and Qinghai, but they also diffuse eastward into the northern reaches. I met Peter and Paul just after their paper came out as I was applying to graduate schools. Peter had been part of a study team looking into the 1975 Haicheng earthquake, and he was eager to understand whether it had really been predicted, and if so, how. When he received my application to MIT, with my degree in Chinese and physics, he saw an opportunity. Peter told me that if I accepted his offer from MIT, he would do whatever he could to get me to China. I promptly withdrew my applications to other graduate schools. When the Haicheng earthquake struck on February 4, 1975, China was still embroiled in the Cultural Revolution. China had been through tumultuous times since the success of the Communist Revolution in 1949. The People's Republic of China under the Communist Party was not recognized by most of the world's governments, and at first, China relied heavily on financial backing from the Soviet Union. Chairman Mao Zedong, having succeeded in driving out General Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party, became impatient with the slow pace of reform in Chinese society and of being in the shadow of the Soviet Union. He initiated the Great Leap Forward to show that China had leaped beyond the socialism of the USSR to true communism, in which society would deploy its labor and distribute funding as Karl Marx had proposed in 1875. From each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. The result was catastrophic, killing by starvation more people in 2 years than any natural disaster described in this audiobook. Forced collectivization of farms took away the incentive for hard work. People were made to donate their farm labor and would be fed whether they worked or not. This led to the most lethal famine in human history, killing at least 20 million people, perhaps as many as 30 million. In 1963, more than half the people who died in China were under the age of 10. In the face of such losses, other members of the Communist Party's Central Committee successfully sidelined Mao to protect the people from his grand visions of pure communism. The party continued to promote Mao as the great helmsman, though, because the propaganda around his cult of personality was effective. For 2,000 years, China had had an emperor. "The East is Red" was an unofficial anthem of the revolution, with the words, "The East is Red, the sun has risen, from China has arisen Mao Zedong. He brings happiness to the people. He is the people's great guiding star." Young Chinese citizens raised on this propaganda were ready to act at Mao's behest. He forged them into a devastating weapon to reclaim his power. The 10 years of Mao's Cultural Revolution, from 1966 to 1976, were for many a reign of terror. Young people turned on their parents and teachers, often encouraged to attack them, even physically. They created public struggle sessions, where the victims would be publicly humiliated, forced to bow to the children of the Red Guard, and be beaten with sticks or chains. Much of the Communist Party leadership at all levels was imprisoned and killed. Teenaged Red Guards roamed the country, joining in attacks on locals who were seen as too intellectual, too reserved, too suspicious. You could be attacked for having received a Japanese education in the 1930s, or for having a relative who worked for the nationalist government decades earlier. Schools and universities were closed. A whole generation of children was for years denied an education. It is hard for those of us who weren't there to comprehend the level of disruption to all aspects of life this represented. Where I worked at the Chinese Earthquake Authority, Guojia Dizhanju, translated then as State Seismology Bureau, the youngest Chinese scientists were 36 years old. They had finished graduate school by 1966, just before the revolution began. The ideology of the Cultural Revolution attacked the party's elite, but it also had a very strong anti-intellectual component. Early in the formation of the People's Republic, 8 categories had been declared enemies of the people: landlords, rich peasants, counter-revolutionaries, bad elements, a general category of the criminally inclined, rightists, traitors, foreign agents, and capitalist roaders, those who believed in capitalism. With his Cultural Revolution, Mao added intellectuals as a 9th category. They were the stinking 9th, a pun on a word that could mean either stinking or arrogant. Many researchers, scientists, and teachers were humiliated, beaten, and even killed for the crime of intellectual work. The horrors of the Cultural Revolution became the seed of the Chinese Earthquake Prediction Program. In March 1966, as the Cultural Revolution was just starting to take shape, a series of earthquakes occurred near Xingtai in Hebei Province. The series began with a magnitude 6.8 event, followed by several other magnitude 6 earthquakes, and finally, a magnitude 7.2 3 weeks later. Together they killed 8,064 people by official reports and caused damage as far as Beijing, about 200 miles away. Premier Zhou Enlai went to the epicentral area and urged earth scientists to develop earthquake predictions that could spare future Chinese casualties. The West had shown no real interest in the seemingly intractable problem of earthquake prediction. Dr. Charles Richter of Caltech was famously quoted as saying that all earthquake predictors were either charlatans or fools. But a prominent Chinese geologist, Dr. Li Siguang, who had led an effort to identify Chinese petroleum deposits and thus develop a measure of energy independence, put his name behind the effort, and it quickly moved forward. It is impossible to know all Premier Zhou's motivations for initiating such an effort. Many of the scientists I interacted with saw it as a clever move on Zhou's part, a way to insulate at least some of the country's intellectual resources from the worst ravages of the Cultural Revolution. Perhaps Zhou had the foresight to see how attacks on intellectuals could damage China's future. By creating such a program for earthquake prediction, he had a reason to keep scientists working, sparing them from Mao's re-education camps. One scientist I worked with told me,